Accession number 14975, William Rochester, reel 11.
Mr. Rochester, reel 11. When did you leave the Sudan for England?
I think it was somewhere around about the Christmas time. 37. It might have been before that because I was married in July, 13th of July, 47. 3 weeks or a month after that, when I left. I think I had 3 weeks married before, and then I went back. So that's August, September. When we went back, I went back on the Pinot liner, and there was around about 30 of us. I've got a few photographs of us in Cairo when we came on leave. We were attached to some artillery, I think it was, in company. They were very good to us. They run us all over, you know, waiting on the boat, run us all over Cairo. They took us to the pyramids. Four of us climbed a pyramid. They're in blocks about 4 foot, you know, and it's difficult. And yet there's a chap there stands, he bets you so much money that he can get up the top in so many minutes and back again. And he always does. He has a special way. But there's four of us went up there. Joe Soap had the camera, and there's three of them sitting there, and I took a photograph of them up there. But, you know, that's it, come back again. And when I got the thing developed, when we're here, and when I went back, I took a photograph back. I said, "There you are, there on the top." And Nobby up on the other one. Never mind. I think it was Nobby, the sergeant major, said, "Hey, you on the run, Bill?" And it just dawned on me then, months afterwards, that I said, "Well, that must be me. That's me shattered on the floor." On the floor.
Was this a civilian boat you were coming back with?
Yes, Pinot liner. We had a good time coming back on there. There was myself and Cattison, two PT instructors. As soon as the boat left Southampton, I said to Catty, "Look," I said, "I'm going to get myself fit. Start now. We've had about nearly 5 months leave. We'll be as sloppy and soft when we're met, so let's get started." So we started doing a bit of PT ourselves. Next day.
This was where?
On the boat.
On the boat.
On the boat.
When the boat left Port Said?
It left to go, left Southampton to go back there.
Oh, sorry.
When we're going back. We wanted to get...
Oh, this is when you were on leave and you were going back.
We're on leave and we were going back. And about the second day, I said, "Look, I'm going to get fit. We'll do a little bit of exercise and a bit of trucking around the ship and that." He said, "I think we're better. We might as well do it together." So we were trekking around and doing a little bit of exercises, you know, in a space on the middle of the ship. I don't know what they call it. Like, it was on the middle of the ship. And there was kite games on one side and another, what were the nets up on there, where you can play games, you see. So we had a bit of PT, and then we started playing, throwing the kite thing on, catching it and throwing it back again, you know. Then on the ground, there's a where you can slide, I don't know what it was. We're sliding something up, something flat. It reminded me of the play in Scotland on the ice and throw it up the ice, only it wasn't as big as that, you know, it was along the deck. And the next day, next morning we turned out, and there was about four or five people there and said, "Could we join you?"
Can I just get this clear? Because when you left Sudan in the Christmas, around about the Christmas of 37, and went home on the P&O liner, was this the end of your service abroad? When you left the Sudan,
yeah,
at Christmas 1937,
we're back in England.
You're
for
going
good.
Back to England for good. That's where we are now. Yes. I thought we're talking about going back to Sudan.
Oh
again.
No, sorry. Then so it was when we're on leave, and yeah, I went back to the Sudan.
I'm with you now. Can we stick to getting back to the England?
Yes. Yeah.
When you got back in England, what happened to you then?
Well, we got back to England and. We were like an advance party. The whole battalion came back together, not the advance part. The whole battalion came back together, and we went into Woking, the prison, the old prison at Woking was our depot there. And of course, 95% of the draft of the battalion went on leave. And the ones that were on leave were left at the barracks. We had to look after the barracks till they come back, because we'd been on leave. So I thought, well, that's fine. Well, in the meantime, I got digs down there. I found a place down there. I got in touch with Tommy. I sent a letter up to Tommy. She didn't have a telephone. She has a telephone from the main street, like normally when I was away anywhere. And they told her I had digs. Would she like to get herself packed up and come down? So she got ready and we picked her up at the station. And we got digs down there. That's fine. But I still wasn't old enough to be recognised by the army, so we had to live on our 30 bob a week. My pay was 25 bob a week for 3 weeks and 30 bob for the other week as a sergeant. So shortly after that, I got made sergeant major. But never mind, that was that happened there. Then we went, we had digs down there. And I don't think I was there very long at all. I can't remember what time it was, but I wasn't too long there, three or four months or something. And I came in one night. I'd been told that I'd been posted as a sergeant to the depot in Newcastle. So I came in the house one night about 5 o'clock and I said, I'm sorry, love, but we're packing up, we're going back to Newcastle tomorrow.
So this would be what, early 1938?
That would be early 1938. And I went up to, I was a sergeant at the depot.
Time 38, right?
Yes, I landed. We came up, we went to our mum's place up there because we didn't have any place at all. And I had to go in there. We stayed with them on the main road, to pull down now that was it. I went into the depot the following year to report in there. And I got digs just outside the depot on the, I don't know what they call the road, the depots and the crossroads. And that goes straight up. This one goes down onto the main road at the bottom, at the top of the haymarket. And then the first house there, I was in digs. So we just walked around. Well, actually, we come in the back door, round the back in there. So I got digs there. Because I still wasn't 26 to get in the depot. And the day I was, the day after I was 26, the quartermaster sent for me. He said, I've got a flat for you. And it was a three-storey. And it was up at the top. Well, Tommy was pregnant. No. Yes, she was pregnant. And we wanted the bottom one if we could. So we couldn't get it straight away, but we got the pregnant one before Bill was born, anyhow, down at the bottom, on the ground floor. Up there. He played a game with us, the quartermaster. He's an
did
old
you
friend.
Find, as you probably did do, a great change from serving abroad to serving at the depot in England?
Yes. For some reason or other, you didn't seem to have any time for yourself. There was always something to do. You had 32 chaps there with a corporal and a sergeant. Now, we're jumping a bit because when I first went to the depot, I went as education officer.
What was your task then?
Teaching. I had four or five classes every day, teaching them basically for the third degree certificate, which was regimental history. They had to write a letter, teach them how to write a letter, and learning all about the history, the battle honours, if they've got to repeat the battle honours and this, that and the other, you know. I think and that was it. That was their exam thing, not to do that.
What was the quality intellectually of the recruits you were getting?
Educationally, very poor. Some of them couldn't even write. I teach some of them to write their name. I couldn't do anything else with them. As long as I can get them to write, sign the name and see it, the letters, you know, spell it out. And to spell it for them, some of them, and that's all. But you got your bright boys. There were some very good boys, very good lads in there. They were probably better than what I was for all I had an education course, but they had a good schooling, some of them had, but a fair mixture, but I think the majority of them were lower educated, lower down.
The backgrounds, was it still very largely a mining background they were coming from?
Yes, basically mining. We did have other people come from industrial sides, they worked in factories and things like that. One or two had just left school and come in. They wanted to be in the army. Nothing, they should never have been there, they should have been somewhere else. They should have gone back to college and then into the... Otherwise, they're quite... and half a dozen of them that later became officers. You know, you could more or less pick out he's a bit more, he should be a bit higher than this sort of style. You know, he shouldn't... the education he's had and the way he was speaking and all that, he shouldn't be with this crowd, otherwise he'll drop down to them. They'll never come up to him, he'll come down to them. And you had to try and keep your eye on him and say, you don't talk like that here, you know. Otherwise he was dropping down. And it seemed to me a shame that he was going to lose something that he had.
How did you feel becoming an education sergeant from being a very active company platoon man?
Well, I thought it was a good rest. I had a wife and a kid to look after. But
you enjoyed it, did you?
Oh, I did, yes. I enjoyed it. But I wanted to be on the square, actually. But we had an educational officer with us who was in the Army Education Corps. He's an older person. And I don't know what he was there for. He never did anything. There was nothing for him to do. Unless he did more, unless he did something with the artillery, which was at the other end of the barracks. You know, there's one barracks, there's artillery one half and the other. And they could have a school as well. I don't know what he did. He didn't do very much. I know when the war started, he brought some certificates for me to transfer to the Army Education Corps. I said, no, what's that for? Ah, he said, you don't want to be in this army, you want to be in our army. It's intelligence. You've got a brain. You can use your brain. You can do this. You go into this department. You go into that department. I said, look, I'm in my department. I'll start with me Durham's. And Aina agreed with me. She said, if that's what you want, go.
So how long were you in education?
Till the war started, I think. From then on, I don't know when it would be, 37, 38. Well, the war started in 1939.
So you came to the depot as an education sergeant and stayed in that position until the war started?
No. I was only there for about 3 months. I was a squad sergeant. Yeah. I was on the...
So 3 months you went back to your...
I went back onto the square.
What squad were you given?
It was either Ian's or Ladysmith. I'm not quite sure. It was one of those two, Ladysmith squad. That was...
What was your role as a training sergeant?
Well, the best way to put it, I think, is a father to a family. You had to be a father, both mother and father. And that was the only way, I think, you could keep your eye on everything that was going on. And you had to have your eye on. Because a lot of them could do things that they could be punished for, and I think they were ridiculous. They should have been just laughed off or told, you know. But in those days, at the depot, discipline was very, very strict. And every little thing, you got clubbed for it. Well, I think that would spoil a decent bloke. It would take all his confidence away. And he would be inward. He would go inward rather than come outward. And I used to tell him about it. For goodness sake, if you're thinking about doing anything, talk to somebody else about it first. Preferably to come and see me or the corporal. Come and see and talk to us for it. And if it's something good and a joke and a funny, we'll probably join you. Or if it's something that you might be punished for, or you may be affected by it, we'll tell you to forget it. And this was the general routine through all the squads I had at the depot, right through. And I still used to give them wet shirts. I think I've told you about a couple of years ago at the annual dinner. You know, the DLI have got an annual weekend. Well, I was down one Sunday at the annual weekend. It starts on Friday night and Saturday and Sunday. and I was standing the where they all meet, Cadman Hall, I think they call it. And a chap come up, was talking, standing talking, and a chap come up and said, "Sergeant Major Rochester," and I said, "No, he died in 1944." And the chap that was with me said, "Don't be that, it is him." What? I said, "Sorry, it is. Who are you? What do you want?" He said, "Oh, you don't know me, but there's four or five people over there want to have a word with you. Would you come across?" Did I tell you?
Huh? This was the wet shirt. What do you mean by wet shirt?
I went across. And sit down. So I sat down, and they just nobody spoke or anything. They just, And then somebody said, "Where they've been, so and so doesn't even recognise us now. Doesn't know who we are." I said, "I'm sorry, I don't know who you are at all. And what do you want?" You know, and then another one had a bit swear and somewhere else, and then I said, "Oh no, look, you can get lost. I'm just stopping in." I got up to walk away, but I was grabbed and sat down again. And eventually, one of them started laughing. He said, "Look, it's true. He doesn't know who we are. He doesn't know who we are. He said, "Many a ruddy white sweaty shirt you've given us, and you don't know who we are." I said, "I'm afraid I don't know who you are." He said, "You were our squad corporal at the depot in 1932 or something, something like that, you know." Then he produced a photograph, Ladysmith photograph.
So your wet shirt basically was that you drilled them so hard they sweated.
I used to make them sweat.
In every squad, you've got a very wide range of personalities. Yes, obviously, yes. One or two, although they were signing on for the army, would be finding themselves a bit nervous about it. Mm-hmm. How did you personally, what was your system of relating to them and bringing them on?
Well, I used to tell them that they're no different to anybody else. If you're doing something strange, there's something hits you in the air and you wonder, why? What have I done this for? Do I like it? Will I like it? I've got to like it because I can't get out. I said, "Yeah, you know, tell them that." And they said, that's your big point now. You've got a problem to get out. You've got to like it. You either like it or you don't like it. Now, you must think now, you're in for 7 years at least. Are you going to have 7 years of hell because you don't like it? Or are you going to say, "Tittle, I like it and I'm going to enjoy it and have 7 years of enjoyment and then you can get out"?
Was there any way in which a recruit coming in suddenly decided, "Oh, this isn't for me"? Could they get out?
No.
At this time?
No.
They were stuck there.
There had to be something very, very different, you know, something like. We got one man out because, like I told you before, he couldn't watch, he couldn't do this, he couldn't do that. The lads used to bump him over the rails and that. But he was just, he couldn't do anything. So he was got out that way. And during the war, I got two or three people out during the war. Not because they were no good, because of their previous employment. And they were very, very thankful for it as well. And I benefited by it years afterwards sometimes. You know, a couple of years afterwards, I got one chap out who was in charge of the depot, of the Naffy depot, and he was called up to be in the army. He was freaking hopeless. He was a clerk, so we eventually got him out and he got his job back again. We moved up Northumberland, and we had to come down to Newcastle to the headquarters to get the food. First bloke I saw was him. "Oh," he said, "I bet you've never had any tins of fruit." I said, "What's that?" "Oh, I'll show you." Tins of fruit for the sergeant's mess. And I had the quartermaster down as well, and we got whiskey for him. Cocoa.
Did you learn basically by experience how to manage men of different personalities? I mean, one hand you'd have people who were deeply regretting coming into the army. Mm-hmm. The other end in the same squad, you have people who would probably be described as wild ones. Mm-hmm. Was it a something that you learned as you went along yourself?
Yes, I think so. You did get the difference. You've got nutters, we call them. Who weren't really, they were just full of energy and they wanted to get rid of it, and some of the energy wasn't right to do where they did it, sort of style. But I mean, I think they shouldn't get punished for it. They would have done it if they'd been caught outside, but if it's in the barrack room, all right, we can let them get on with it as long as they tidy up when they're finished. But I used to try and put a chap between the three of them, between the other two, talk to this this one, that the energetic one, who liked the services, he liked his sport and this and the other, talked to him about this fella who didn't like it very much. Pass some of your energy onto him if you can, via the third one, or get together. And this one, tell him, go to him and say, how do you do that? Why do you, you must like it, and that, you know. And so they got talking to each other, preferably in threes, a one that could understand them both. If you could select them out like that, it was very good. And I found it paid off. I think I was happy enough, and I had a pretty good all the way through, even my company. I thought the world of the company, and we always had somebody at home in the digs where we were. I think I've told you about Ina. We were down in the south of England. Oh, it's probably too early to talk about it, though, now. Stick to the depot.
Your role as a sergeant, were you training with your men all the time, or did you pass a certain amount on to your corporal and you were doing something else?
Well, you can't do it all the time. The corporal and the lance corporal have got to do certain things that you don't do. You've got something else to do, you see. But invariably, you do something every day, a part of the training every day, either as a group or as a section, and take a section of them at a time. And the smaller your group, the more you can push into them. If you've got 30-odd people, you've got to go by the slowest one. And you don't know whether you're getting that far or whether you're going too fast for them. But if you have a small group, you can pick them out, the ones that are not getting what you're talking about. And sometimes you can't even get a good session with them. But nevertheless, you can get to them if you have a smaller group. And I always try to be a friend to them all. I bollocked them. Oh, yeah. If it was necessary. But not in front of everybody else. Unless the whole lot caught what was wrong. And I just talked to them. Never bollocked them. Talk to them that was wrong. They all see that you've done wrong, so you should say the same, you see. But if you got a bollocking, I always caught them afterwards, dragged them in out the road of everybody else. So not drag them in, but catch them when the scores were finished, and then give them a good rollicking, a really good bollocking and rollicking then. But even at the depot, we invariably had somebody in the house. I used to smoke at the time. Ken's it is, and he always got four for your friend. John Henry, I never saw the four for my friend. John used to take them out, she used to take them out, and give them to the coal men and things like that. And I had four men, civilians, who had been soldiers, that had been in my platoon in India. I was the platoon sergeant in India. They had finished their 7 years. There was three of them from Sunderland and one from Hetton, from Elswick in Newcastle. They were employed in the depot as employed men in the dining room, looking after the dining room and all, looking the bread and sweeping up and tidying up in there. And they used to be over at my house on a Monday every week, kind of borough. So, well, they wouldn't see me. I say, look, I've got no. Go and see the boss over there. Go and see Tommy. They'd go over there, and we were saving up for Billy to buy the pram and all that, my son. And she would let them have some cash. I don't know what it was, but they got the cash on the Monday. On the Friday, as soon as they got paid, back went the money. Monday, after again, got paid. She said, it was right. And when war was declared, I was still at the depot, and we were in the miniature range, and I was in there 3 days. I never got home for 3 days. I was sleeping on a couple of blankets on the firing point, because the trains were coming in all hours, you know, and you had to document them and all kinds of things. And I never knew how many people were living with somebody else. Not married, they were married, but they were living with somebody else. We had to call them you should know that now, what they called them. The wives. Common law
partners.
Wife. Common law wife. Oh. No, we had to put it down, common law wife, because they had to make a will, you know.
We can come back to that later. What was the quality of recruit NCOs training the soldiers at that time in the depot?
Well, the majority of them, I think, there was five lance corporals together. I was one of the lance corporals together there, and I think the five of us all wanted to be soldiers, and we all did our time as soldiers right away along.
So in 1938, with war coming along, mm-hmm. the standard of training mm-hmm. was of a high quality?
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. It got harder.
But bearing in mind, without going into details on the war, which we'll come to, but bearing in mind that what you had to do during the war and what mm-hmm. kind of training mm-hmm. you were given mm-hmm. recruits in 1938, mm-hmm. would you say that it helped you in the war situation? Was it good training in that sense? Or did you find it a tremendous change?
Not in 38. We have bigger change in 38, because in 38 we're at the depot, and we didn't have any area to do anything much except the Meyer Dam in Newcastle, and that's just wide open spaces.
So basically, it is basic training at the
basic
depot.
Basic training all the time.
That was what I was trying
discipline.
To establish. Yes.
Yeah, we had to be harder on discipline. If I said to, if the squad was standing, I was talking to them, and I suddenly shouted, "Down, down, down," and they didn't get down, they got walloped. They said, "Right, you know what's happening now. No pass this weekend if we go outside. Buck yourself up, or you'll get another one." That was my orders. You know what it's for. You obey an order instantly. You don't say why, when, what am I doing that for. You get down and get the only answer afterwards.
And
I did that in the barracks.
Do you recall the name of the commanding officer of the depot at that time, 1938?
V.A. Y.I.
What was he like?
Gentleman. He was of German origin, I think. It was a German name. It was spelt Y.I. W, you know, but everybody called him Y.I. And I told you that he came to visit us, and of course my girlfriend said, "Good morning, Mr. Y.I." He just laughed at it. And his wife came round to see it. She said, "What was it?" She said something about, I think Tommy will remember better, "I've come to see the lady that called my husband Y.I. or something like that, you know.
Do you recall any of the other officers in the depot? 1938?
I don't think there was just a quartermaster. I don't think there was any other officers there. Just the company sergeant major and the sergeants. They didn't need any officers. He was a major in charge of the depot. I don't think there was any others.
Who was the quartermaster?
Robson. He had ex-RSM from India. And he was the quartermaster at the depot.
Your fellow sergeants, do you recall any of those by name?
Three R's. Rochester. I can't even remember. The sergeant was the R, the corporal was R, and the lance corporal was R. And we went right through the depot, just up. It'll come back. I mean, I've got a photograph, so no, I think I'll give it away. Ridley? No, sorry, I can't.
What signs of war were coming along at this point?
Well, there was a bit of talk about it, but I think that was about all. We heard the radio and heard things that were on the radio and all that, but I don't think it never ended my mind that the war was coming on.
You didn't feel it was imminent at
no,
this stage?
No, I did. Possibly because we didn't want it to. That's possibly a big idea, but we got quite a surprise when the siren sounded on the Sunday morning, and I never saw so much stupidity in my life.
In what sense?
Well, the people that ought to have had more sense and knew it was only a sign to let you know that war had started. Not that there's any bombers coming. They were running around shouting, "The planes are coming." The women come out and they're shouting, "Planes are coming out. Get yourself into shelters. There's no shelters for us here. They're going to bomb us."
Where was this?
Fenton Barracks. You've never seen a senior bloke, I know.
So everyone panicked.
Oh, I've never seen anything like it.
What were you doing when that actual announcement came through?
I was in the barracks, in the room itself, in the barracks, when I heard a blow. I heard the siren go on.
You hadn't heard the radio announcement by the Prime Minister?
No, I hadn't, no. And I went downstairs. I was on the third floor. I went down the third floor, straight across the square, into the house to see Tommy. And she said, "Bill, just listen to them out there. Look at them. The women were running outside, shouting, 'They're going to bomb us! They're going to bomb us!' The war started. 'They're going to bomb us!'"